This episode is brought to you by Fortis et Fidelis, honoring the brave and faithful service of our fallen. The free will never forget.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of the Brave and Faithful podcast. Today, man, I got a special treat for you guys. So his name's Dr. Robert Adams, or Dr. Bob Adams, as referred to his patients. So Dr. Bob, he's a former Navy SEAL. He's been with the Army as well, with the Delta Force, and also with the Airborne. So spent 18 years in the Navy, 18 years in the Army, with a total combined service of 36 years. He's an author of 2 books, and we'll talk about that in the podcast here. But yeah, it's a special treat for you guys, Dr. Robert Adams. Dr. Rob, or Bob, sorry. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Awesome. So, you know, there's a lot to unpack from that intro. I like to refer second service, but you've had many multiple services, first with the Navy, and then the Army, and then now as a doctor in the civilian sector. Can you first off start from the beginning, kind of just tell us about your military background and your journey?
Sure. I come from 5 generations of career military men. I was Naval Academy, class of 73. My dad was Naval Academy 43. My granddad was superintendent of the Naval Academy and a 3-star admiral, class of 1926. And his father was a West Pointer, class of 1894. And I'm writing my 3rd book right now about my great-great-grandfather, who served in the Civil War in General Grant's headquarters. And it just... it goes way back, but I never planned to be in the military. Right. Literally, I watched moving every 3 years going, yeah, I don't want to do this. But then in 1968, I think, 67, Reader's Digest published an article about this new secret organization called Navy SEALs. I read it and I went, oh, that's what I want to do. So went back, grabbed my dad, and said, okay, how do I get into the academy? I want to go play now. And of course, I showed up at the academy saying, I want to be a SEAL. And this was in the 60s. It was a secret organization for 5 years. And they said, nah, you don't want to do that. You can't. There's no career in it. And back then, there was no career in special operations. You might make 05, 06, you know, rarely. But one of my classmates who got his slot to SEAL training, there were only 3 for our class, 3 for our class. Mm. He stayed in and became our first 4-star Navy SEAL. So the career opportunities did change over the years. But, I didn't get one of those first 3 slots. So I went out on a destroyer for 1.5 years and applied to come to SEAL training from the fleet and happily got in. Was one of 70 men that started SEAL training with Bud's class of 81, and 11 of us made it.
You were the class lead, correct?
Well, I was one of 8 officers when we started. When I graduated, I was the class leader, because by the time we started Hell Week, we had lost the 2 officers senior to me. Matter of fact, it was literally on the first night of Hell Week that an Army Green Beret, he'd been a captain and resigned his commission to come be a SEAL, quit. And they all looked at me and go, okay, Mr. Adams, you're it now. What? Yeah. I was trying to hide. It didn't work out. But, there 11 of us made it. And that's what my first book is about. And then after serving my 5-year payback time with the active duty SEALs, I transferred to the reserves and went back to school to get an MBA and try to decide what else I wanted to do. Because back in the late 70s, post-Vietnam, military was a really hard place to be because there was no money, drawdown was going on. I said, I'll go try something else. And for those of you that are in the military now, pay attention to what I'm about to say. I made a terrible mistake. 6 months out into the civilian world, I realized they don't have 30 days of paid vacation out here. They don't have paid, health insurance. Dang. I called the Navy right back up and said, I made a mistake, bring me back. And they went, "Yeah, we don't need any more SEALs. We're in a drawdown now. Stay in the reserve. We'll call you if there's a war." So I was stuck. And although I enjoyed being in the reserves, I went back to school, got my MBA, went to work in DC as a consultant, but working for the Naval Sea Systems Command. But I didn't like it very much. I came home, 6 months into my new job with a new baby at home, and said, "I don't like what I'm doing. I think I'm going to have to go be a doctor." And my wife goes, "What? You're 30 years old, second child's on the way. What are you thinking?" And I said, "Well, I'm thinking I want to do something that's much fun as being a Navy SEAL platoon commander, and the Navy won't take me back. So I'm going to med school." So I popped off a scholarship request to the Navy and the Army. Navy said, "Here's your 3-year scholarship." Army said, "Here's your 4. And so I changed uniforms, because med school is very expensive, and the Army offered me the better deal.
They offered you more. Yeah.
And I throw that in there because people always ask me, "Wait a minute, you were a Navy SEAL. How come you're an Army doctor?" And it simple was, they paid for the school, and it worked out to be a much, much better opportunity, because as you had mentioned earlier, I no sooner finished my residency, showed up to my first assignment on Fort Bragg, and Delta Force came knocking on my door going, "Listen, about that Navy SEAL patch on your Army uniform, would you like to come play with us?" Wow. And so I ended up being the command surgeon for Army's Delta Force, doing quick reaction operations for 4 years. And that finished, and I actually made full bird colonel by then. I mean, I went from Navy 05 commander to Army second lieutenant to go to med school, and then had to work my way back up. But by now, I'm a full bird colonel, and I took command of a clinic on Fort Bragg, and then Iraq happened, and I was invited to go to Iraq with the 82nd Airborne Division, which was a marvelous experience to be with soldiers, again, of that quality. These guys, like all soldiers, worked their ass off in a very hard environment. It was, war is never a pleasant experience for anybody, and that is equally true for doctors. But finished that tour, came back, retired from the Army in 2006, and then opened private practice in a little town called Knightdale, North Carolina, on the beach side of Raleigh, North Carolina, and started private practice there. I actually built a clinic from the ground up, and worked there for 13 years until just literally retiring last year as a civilian doctor, and with 13 years of taking care of the patients here. And I want to comment for people that are interested in the difference between military and civilian medicine. And I talk about that in book number 2 right there, which is my Swords and Saints, a Doctor's Journey. Saints, yeah. There's a big difference between the military and the civilian world. The biggest difference being that in the military, we are defended by the United States government. So there's no malpractice insurance to pay. We're allowed to deliver our own babies. I'm a family physician. So deliver my babies, take care of them while they grow up. Watch the moms, the dads, the brothers, the sisters, womb to tomb care, I call it. And so we get much, much better training. If I needed to go scrub in on a surgery, one of my patients, which I did routinely, welcome to the operating room. Let's go. Let's take care of your patients. In the civilian world, you can't deliver babies anymore. That adds $100,000 to your malpractice insurance, and you can't do your vasectomies because that's a surgical procedure, and we don't want you to do that either. And
you're a lot more restricted.
You're very, very restricted. And as a result, military trained doctors are very sought after in the civilian world. And my patients were equally enthusiastic. When I retired last year, I turned many of them over to another doctor that I like. And he just texted me this morning going, "Man, your patients can't stop talking about you. I'm not sure I can live up to your reputation." But it's just a different world. And if you ever have the opportunity to see a military doctor in the civilian or VA world, go that pathway, because we tend to be much more broad-based in our skill set. So that's it in a nutshell.
So just going back with your military service, what was kind of like your biggest takeaway? I mean, you've served, like you mentioned earlier, a total of 36, 18 with the Navy, 18 with the Army. What was your biggest takeaway from the military? And what would you say was the differences between the two branches that that you've been able to apply since leaving the military?
Well, that's a key question that you asked, and I appreciate it. There is a big difference between the two branches that I saw firsthand. The Navy, because of its ship-based operations, has a tendency to place way more organizational emphasis on the officer corps. And in other words, you know, if a ship at sea can marry people and the commanding officer is responsible for everything and that ship runs aground, the CO gets relieved, the enlisted men tend to wait for the officer to tell them what to do and then they go do it. The opposite is the case in the Army. In the Army, they develop their enlisted corps from the ground up. As soon as you pin on E4, you're a leader and a manager in the Army. And that's a tremendous experience for the enlisted people to realize you're being asked to lead men into combat type situations. And the chain of command goes all the way up to the senior enlisted men, and then they're the ones to decide whether they want to bring the officers in or not. You know, the officers give a mission, you know, give a direction, give an authority, and they're still, you know, finally responsible. But if you as a young officer try to be the boss, you're not going to be successful in the Army. So there, you know, that's a big, big difference. I think both officer and enlisted in both services develop their own way, but the difference was noticeable in how much responsibility are given early on in a Army enlisted man's career.
Okay. And then just next question here is, you mentioned your transition when you left, you left the Navy and you said, oh man, that was a big mistake. But what kind of led you into going the route of pursuing your medical degree? Like, was that something that you've always wanted to do, or what kind of led you to doing that?
I would have never, ever considered it had I not made the initial mistake of getting out and seeking my fortune elsewhere. And literally when I was working through schooling, getting a master's in business and trying to focus on money as a future, what I realized is that money had no morals and it had no ethics. And I didn't like that. The military, you know, it has a code of ethics and its men and women live by it on a daily basis. Well, you don't find that in the business world. And I started to think to myself, well, what do I want to do? I said, I want to find the kind of joy of going to work that I got when I was a Navy SEAL. I mean, it was, I literally would go to bed at night going, damn, I got to sleep 8 hours before I can get up and do it again. And it was that much fun, you know, and working with the quality of men and women that we get to work with in the military, it's just very hard to find in the civilian world. So I started looking around, and what brought me to the medical decision, I don't have any doctors in my family as role models, was when I was at the Naval Academy, biology was one of my favorite subjects, my only A+ that I got there. And I had a great mentor as a biologist. I started thinking, well, what do people who like biology do? You go, wait, doctors do that. So I started looking into it. And then one day I came home to my wife and said, I think I found what I want to do. And she said, well, go for it. You're too old anyway. They probably won't accept you. But it took me 3.5 years of going back to school, taking all my prerequisites over again, applying to med school, and then finally getting accepted. And I got to go to Wake Forest University on a full Army scholarship with now 2 children in hand. But it turned out to be one of the best decisions of my life. I absolutely adored being a doctor. I loved being a medical student. I loved being a resident in training. And then poof, when I showed up on Fort Bragg as a new doctor, able to train younger doctors, actually bumped into another Navy SEAL Army doctor. And I just finished a wonderful conversation with him about the great things he's doing in treating PTSD now as another family physician. And so it's just a fun world, and it led me to places that allowed me to enjoy every minute of every day again.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. And it's funny, like you mentioned, you know, you didn't, after getting out of the Navy, you weren't really pursuing that route. But then once you got into it, it was as fulfilling as the job that you had prior in the Navy. And, you know, it took you, if you don't mind me asking, how long have you been practicing medicine?
About 33 years.
33 years.
You know, counting medical school until just now. And I'm still advising some companies that need a medical advisor on their staff. And I'm on two boards of directors for veterans. I'm very proud. Anybody from North Carolina that's listening, please be aware that we have just opened the Veterans Life Center north of Durham, North Carolina, and it houses 100 veterans that are transitioning from their civilian, from their military life to a civilian future. We have a community college, drug alcohol rehab center walking distance away, and we've just opened our doors to men and women veterans, and we'll take you, you know, from your homeless status to here, or from your off of active duty, not knowing where to go. And, you know, it's just a brilliant operation funded by an $8 million grant by the state of North Carolina. My other board of directors is a veterans medical investigation program called the Institute for Medical Research. And we oversee the funding for research that can help veterans in the long run medically. So I'm staying busy.
Thank you for sharing that. Can you mention that first program again, just so like for anybody listening might be interested?
Yeah, the website is www.vlcnc.org, Veterans Life Center of North Carolina, .org. You know, please tell your friends. And, you know, I was, my last job at Fort Bragg was the chief of the department that oversaw soldiers returning from war and deployments, and we took care of their medical needs. And I just reached out to the commanding officer down there and said, hey, how many people you got in your unit right now waiting to go home? And found there's 250 soldiers on Fort Bragg planning the rest of their lives. And so we've connected with them, and they're sending us folks that, you know, sadly, a lot of divorces happen in the military, and oftentimes a National Guard soldier will deploy overseas, come home, find you doesn't have a wife or kid anymore. And now what am I going to do? Well, come stay with us. We'll get you organized, help you build a new career, and, you know, get on with your life.
So, you know, 36 years of service, that's a lot of experience, a lot of positions you've held. Kind of putting you on the spot here, but what would you say was kind of your favorite position that you had, Navy or Army?
Well, that's a tough one because, you know, as I've said before, the best job I think I ever had in my entire life, it was as a Navy SEAL platoon commander. We were able to do anything and everything we wanted, jumping out of airplanes, blowing things up, scuba diving, training for war, with some of the greatest men ever. But then when I moved forward to, you know, later on in life, I had similar thrills and excitement in medical school, delivering my first baby. I mean, what an amazing experience. And then as a resident, you know, doing surgeries and, you know, helping other doctors think through how to help things. And, you know, the beauty of family medicine is we do everything from pediatrics to geriatrics to surgery to psychiatry. And, you know, I mentioned Dr. Shaw, a doctor who was a Navy SEAL turned Army family doc just recently. He is now a civilian. We're both retired as Army colonels. And he is developing a brand newly approved treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder that is causing instantaneous reversal of the PTSD symptoms. He does something called a ganglion nerve block in the neck on the vagus nerve. And he just finished treating Dakota Myers, a Medal of Honor winner, and had an amazing instantaneous response. And, you know, being able to touch lives like that is just an incredibly rewarding experience.
That's I'd love to know more about that. And hopefully that's a great, you know, way to get back to our veteran community. So Dr. Rob, so in your pursuit of your medical degree, in your time as a family doctor, what would you say has been your worst moment or experience you've had, and how were you able to overcome that experience?
So when I wrote my second book, Swords and Saints, A Doctor's Journey, I sent it to a reviewer, who's a lawyer, a wonderful lady. And she goes, you know, I'm 3/4 of the way through your book, and I'm starting to want you to fail. What? Well, you keep telling all these stories of things that were successful. And, you know, I'm starting to not like that about you. I said, aren't you going to talk about what you did wrong? And I went, ooh, you know, that's hard for any doctor to do or admit. Right. But when I look back at the mistakes I made, those are what you learn from. Those are what you teach your young medical students and residents. And we all make mistakes. My earliest memory of that when I was in residency was one of my senior physicians who said, you know, Bob, we all carry around our own personal private graveyards with us. And we stop and we look at it periodically and we go, I don't ever want to see that happen again. Is anybody that reads about the profession of medicine, he knows that people die in hospitals unnecessarily and people die of medication errors unnecessarily, because one of the themes that I wrote into this new book is that I want you to understand that a doctor is in training from day one until day end of career. But we know enough to be dangerous for many, many years during the training process. And I warn my patients, if the doctor doesn't make sense, ask another question. If something doesn't make sense, you know, review it with Dr. Google. Dr. Google is a great resource, you know.
Double check.
Medical students are dangerous. Residents are more dangerous. And brand new doctors are even more dangerous because, you know, you got the MD, there's no supervising you. And, you know, I remember I was 3 years at Fort Bragg into my new job as a teacher. I'm delivering babies, teaching residents about delivering babies, you know, doing my own C-sections, just amazing things that, you know, most people never dream of being able to do. And I have a chapter in my book where I talk about cutting into the abdomen of a lady for my very first solo C-section and thinking to myself, if this woman could hear my thoughts right now, I'm pretty sure she would tell me to stop. Because, you know, everybody has to do it the first time. And I was scared to death. And everything worked out well, by the way. But there's been mistakes along the way and errors along the way. And people that have, you know, pulled me aside to say, you know, learn from it, don't do it again.
Want to support an active duty owned brand? Head over to fortis-fidelis.com. Again, that's fortis-fidelis.com, and help us in honoring the brave and faithful service of our nation's defenders. All proceeds will help us create and provide memorial coins to the families of our fallen service members. Again, that's fortis-fidelis.com, and help Fortis et Fidelis in honoring the brave and faithful.
What would you say has been the most rewarding in your 33 years of practicing medicine? What's been the most rewarding experience you've had so far?
So as a doctor, my two most memorable experiences, both of which I've had numerous times, is to bring a new life into the world. There's just God is present when a little baby comes into the world and you hold him in your hand and you hand him to the mom and say, it's a boy. And the second equally God present type of event is to hold somebody's hand when they pass away. I mean, I've so often been there bedside when somebody left this world, and there's just this feeling of an angel on your shoulder when this happens. And it's, you know, there's a couple stories in this book about, you know, what it's like to bring a life into the world, what it's like to see somebody pass away, and including my own father's passing years before I was a doctor. It was a moving experience to watch death happen and see, you know, evidence that there is a soul and it lives on after us. And I, you know, and doctors get to see that more often than most.
I'm sure every day, every experience that's every experience each day is it's a journey, right?
It is. And I'll tell you, I mentioned God. I've always been a believer that God's on my shoulder and God guides me in the decisions that I make. But, you know, so often it comes up in medicine practice. One of my favorite chapters in the book is talking about a new patient, an older gentleman who walks into my office, feet flopping, which is a symptom of Parkinson's disease. And he's new to me and he comes in because his wife brought him in because there's something wrong with him. And I do a full exam, don't find anything except for this, you know, walk of his, order a whole bunch of labs and say, come back and see me on Monday because things like this always happen on a Friday. And so he goes, makes a Monday appointment. And on Sunday night, I did something I almost never do. I said, I'm going to log onto my computer and check his labs because I'm curious. And I look at his labs and they're normal. And I go, okay, I'll send my nurse a note and tell him to call her on Monday and let him know the labs are normal. And a little tap on my shoulder said, really, why are they normal? Maybe you ought to check on him. Because he wasn't normal when he walked into your office. On a Sunday night, again, not something I normally do. I called him and said, how you doing? Doc, I'm much worse. And he told me what was going on. I said, hand the phone to your wife. Call an ambulance. Go into the emergency room right now. I think you're bleeding inside your brain. That's the only explanation for your worsening symptoms of your normal labs. And they operated on him that night and took a softball-sized blood clot out of his brain.
Oh, wow.
And he came back to see me a week later with this, you know, scar on the side of his head. He says, the surgeon wanted me to tell you saved my life. And I said, I need to be really clear about who saved your life. It wasn't me. It was the guy that tapped me on the shoulder and said, call you. And by the way, what do you do for a living? And he goes, oh, I'm a minister. Okay. Well, you got a good relationship with a big guy.
Right. That's a great story. I want to transition into, you know, you kind of mentioned throughout the podcast, your books. What made you, because right now you have two books, 6 Days of Impossible was your first book. And then your second book, Swords and Saints. What made you, you know, to become an author and what made you to write these two books specifically?
So Navy SEALs were prohibited from writing about their experiences because of the classified nature of much of it for many, many, many years. But a few years back, the Navy removed that restriction and people started writing books. And all the books that I would read had their chapter on Hell Week. And I go, come on, somebody explain Hell Week, because I try to explain it to people and they don't understand it. And book after book after book came out. And I went, when is somebody going to tell the world what Hell Week is? So finally, and I called a Navy SEAL author, Dick Couch, who wrote some wonderful books, and said, you need to write a book about Hell Week. He goes, Bob, you do it. It's your experience. So I spent 3.5 years interviewing my 11 classmates that made it through training. And I wrote their individual stories. And I did it as a doctor looking back, because I thought, you know, nobody will deny that Navy SEAL Hell Week is the most difficult military training in the world across all the countries. And only 20-25% of people make it through it. But I wanted to find out why the 11 of us did it. Why us? And I wrote the book wondering what the conclusion would be. That's why it took me 3.5 years. When I finally found what I think is a common theme, I said, aha, I'm going to write this book. And I wrote it one chapter at a time with each interview, looking for that theme. And the purpose of the book, and it's really a book about success and failure for those of you that, you know, want to know what makes somebody successful in any stressful environment, please read the book, because that's why I wrote it. And it's only about those 6 days of Hell Week. It starts on Sunday night at midnight and it ends on Saturday morning. And I walk you through, you know, minute by minute, day by day, person to person, until when you're done, you go, oh, that's what they have in common.
And then you said you wrote it from a doctor's perspective. Right?
Yeah, I figure, you know, as a family physician, I probably treat stress and stress-related diseases more than any single thing. And, you know, SEAL Hell Week is one of the most military stressful events there is. I said, maybe I'll figure it out. So that's why I did it, because nobody else had done it. And nobody's tried to do it since. My second book was very similar motivation, because I got great reviews on the first book. Turns out I am a good writer, and I didn't know that until I wrote this book. And then I said, well, you know, are there any other stories I need to tell? And, you know, I left medicine just last year in almost in protest of the changes that are so negative in the military, in the medical world. I said, you know, I'm tired of dealing with the problems that are, that all doctors have to deal with on a regular basis. But I want to write the story about my experiences because I don't want them to die with me. And so it starts as trying to get into med school, being a medical student, and the fun and the excitement and the challenges that provides, and then into residency when you're learning and being exposed to new things after new things after new things. And then, in, you know, as a more senior doctor, and then going to war as a doctor, you know, going to war with Delta Force, going to war with the 82nd Airborne, the traumas that a doctor at war has to deal with, which are horrendous. And then, you know, sort of easing into the saint-like person I am now that knows all and tells all, the great teacher. Right. At least that's the story, the way I tell it. But again, it was just, I wanted to write that story because it needed to be written. And I'll put a plug in for my next book that's coming out this year. And this is a book that's being written out of necessity. My mother died 2 years ago, and I inherited hundreds of letters from my great-great-granddad in the Civil War. When I mentioned earlier, it was assigned to General Grant's headquarters during the Civil War. Well, she laboriously transcribed 3 years of his 4 years in the Civil War, and I've just finished transcribing the final year. And it's going to be published as a love story. They're all letters to his wife as a soldier, junior enlisted man in the Union Army. Brilliant, brilliant story with all of the events of the Civil War laid out from a junior enlisted man's perspective.
That's awesome. And for those of you guys just joining in, again, talking to Dr. Bob Adams, Navy SEAL, and then Army, total of 36 years of service between the two branches. Just talking about his two books, 6 Days of Impossible and Swords and Saints, and also mentioned a third book that will be coming out pertaining to the Civil War. So a question for me is, one of the things I want to do within 5 years is write my own book. But what's your advice for those maybe just listening in and, you know, wondering, like, how do they start that? How do they start that process?
So that's a great question, because the answer was something I had to discover myself over the years that I was writing a book. To try to get a publisher to publish your book is next to impossible now. And there are probably a million new books a year getting published. So, you know, how are you going to get found? How are you going to make it in the publishing world? And how are you going to tell the story and get people to see it? Well, the answer used to be, you can't do it. Don't try. But that is not the case now. The self-publishing industry has exploded, and now it is very easy to write a book. And there are professionals standing by, ready for you to pay them, you know, to edit your work and make it ready to go, and to design your covers for you. But it's not expensive. You know, I think nowadays, if you've got a good story and you write it down, you might pay an editor $1,000 to make it, you know, book ready. You might say pay a cover designer $300 or $400 to give you a really good cover. And then the beauty of it is you can put a Kindle book online published in an hour. When you've got a cover and you've got a manuscript, you can go to Kindle and for free launch that book to the e-world. Yeah. And then they say, well, wouldn't you like to have that in a hard copy for your friends and family? And sure. And that costs you a little bit, but not much. You simply upload your document and it gets printed. And, you know, most of my books are sold through Amazon, which is the largest bookseller out there. But they sell the e-books and they sell the Kindle books. And they sell the hard copy, you know, a hardbound or softbound. And it's fascinating to me, because I was all worried about, oh, I have to buy all this inventory and keep boxes of books and try to go do books. I need to get them sold. But the industry now when you have a regular publisher or you're a self-publisher and you're done with your manuscript, you simply upload the software to Amazon and they print on demand.
Yeah.
You order a book and they print it. Very cool technology.
Yeah, you don't have to keep inventorying the house or anything.
No. And then, and by the way, both of my books had mistakes in them. And people write me and go, did you mean to spell that word this way? Or, you know, did you mean to say that? And I'm like, oops. And all I do is go, tick, upload new software, and the next book that's printed is fixed.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
But I think the most important thing is just getting your message out there, getting your story out there, right? And I think that's where people kind of just hesitate, is like, oh, they look at so many little things that, you know, might not be as important as just getting the story and the message out to the people that need it. So,
yep. And there's a warning I should add. Most of the "we will publish your book" companies are not worth the money they're going to ask you to pay them. Be careful with who you move forward with. Do your homework, ask around. There's some great online self-publishing groups on Facebook that will, you know, help you pick the right place to go.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that, Dr. Bob. And another thing too is, you know, we might have listeners and who are in the military active duty, you know, going the route of becoming a military doctor, or there might be civilians out there that might pursue or go that route of going to med school. What are some actionable steps that you can provide for them that they can take right now to be successful in those fields?
Specifically medicine you're talking about?
Specifically medicine, yeah.
All right, I'm going to answer that question, but I got to put a plug in for one of your previous podcast guests, Adam Bird, who is a publisher of Heroes Publishing.
Right.
And he has put my first edition out of both of these books and done a great job doing it. And I do recommend him. If you've got a military-themed book, you know, talk to Adam Bird at Heroes Publishing. For as far as advice to people seeking a career in medicine, the first thing I'm going to say is be careful. The world of medicine is not as profitable as it used to be. It is now managed by big corporations, health maintenance organizations. And, you know, I'm just sad to report that the changes are not as positive as they should be. Big medical organizations are failing on a regular basis to make the medical system that we operate in better. They're going to learn how to do it, but they haven't learned it yet. And so just, you know, if you want to be a doctor, do it, because it's the most fun you'll ever have. If you love that profession, but please love it and think seriously about getting some life experiences under your belt before you spend 7, 8, 9 years in med school and residency and then find yourself launched out into the world of, you know, productivity, because you're not paid as much nowadays on salary as you are productivity. And it's hard. They push you real hard because it's all about money in most big organizations. You know, in the family practice world, I think there's only 13% of us that are still in private practice. And most of those are older doctors going, you know, I'm not gonna play the game of electronic medical records and productivity, and I don't want to do it. I'm staying here until I die of old age. And that's fine. But to survive, the system, the insurance companies got exemption from the federal government for the anti-monopoly laws. And they pay a private practice doctor half of what they pay an HMO affiliated doctor. And they do that with the government's permission in order to force the independent doc out of business. And it's sad that that's going on. And I'll take this opportunity just to say real briefly, the way that the big organizations are failing is they're trying to make money by squeezing the doctor. And it's an interesting thing from a business standpoint. And I got my MBA, and I'll tell you this from a business standpoint. When you take the only income producer in your organization, and we're it, nobody else in a medical organization makes any money except the doctor. And our job is to take care of the patients that are paying you money for us to do our job. And you squeeze us and you cut our pay and you cut our benefits and you make us work harder. All you're doing is making us less willing to do a good job.
Yeah.
What you need to do in a big organization is focus everybody in that organization on making the doctor's job easier, more successful, more patient focused, because all of us went into medicine to take care of patients. You help us do that job and pay us fairly, because the money is not the biggest motivator, you're going to end up being a successful organization, save a lot of money, and reverse the trend of failure that the medical system is experiencing right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point you bring out, is you go into the field because you want to help people, and the money is kind of like just the secondary as a result of that. But it's kind of sad to hear that. Would you say it's become more like corporate within the medicine field?
It is corporate. It's a corporate entity. Yeah. I personally will throw a prediction out here. I think we're going to go to a government-managed medical care system, a single-payer system. Medicare works. You know, it was hated by all when it first came out in the 60s, but it works. And it's not the greatest insurance program in the world. But so many people now wait to be 65 to retire just so they can, you know, get an affordable healthcare insurance under their belt, because they can't afford private insurance these days. And if we simply say, okay, now Medicare covers all, well, we've basically instituted a single payer system that we can, you know, make work. The payer is the government. The administrators are still going to be the insurance companies, but they're all going to work for the Medicare organization. I see that coming rapidly.
And real quickly, what do you think that would do with like the individual doctor?
So interestingly, you know, I don't have to make that prediction. You just have to look around the world. You know, there's a single payer system in Canada, a single payer system in England, single payer system in Iraq, where I was. And, you know, the doctors are still doctors doing their job, and they adjust, you know, their lives and performances to the system that they live within. And there's going to be some negatives. Access to care goes down under single payer systems. You know, there a lot of doctors now don't take Medicare insurance because their payment is so low. They're saying, no, thank you. Go see somebody else. You know, and in Canada, just spoke to a good friend of mine up there who says he loves the system, but he also hasn't had to wait a year to get a gallbladder surgery. You know, those people come to the United States and get it done. And in England and in Iraq, you can see the government doctor for free, but if you really want care today, you're going to have to pay for it. So it's it's a mixture of systems that meet the bulk of everybody's needs, but people that have additional resources will always be able to get better care.
I appreciate you for sharing that, Dr. Bob. And I know we kind of went into, the military, Navy, Army, medicine, and then your books. But one last question before we go into our second segment. What's one thing you want our listeners and our viewers to take away from this episode?
You just fed me that line. Buy my books and read them. They're great.
Make sure you get those two books and stay tuned and for the third one, right?
There you go. Absolutely. If you like the Civil War, I think I'm going to call it My Dear Sarah, because all of his letters begin My Dear Sarah. And it's kind of like a, you know, look at the Civil War and a love story to get to boot.
Okay. Awesome. When is that coming out again?
This year sometime. It's in the editing process now.
And then it'll be on Amazon, correct?
Of course, yes.
Okay. All right, so Dr. Bob, going into our second segment here, this is what I call the Fast Five, the same five questions I ask all my guests. Are you ready, sir?
Go for it.
All right, so first question, what's one hobby you enjoy?
Well, I sent you a picture, which you're more than welcome to publish with this podcast, of me holding a 15-pound rainbow trout. Right. And so, you know, fishing has always been my love. And, you know, I'm actually, one of the articles I haven't written yet is why fishing should be part of all medical school residencies, because it's a calming, right, you know, outside of the busy world kind of sport and pastime that I have always enjoyed.
Yeah, definitely a great activity to just calm the mind and get away from it all, from all the stress. So, Next question. If you had to choose one person, dead or living, to hang out with for one day, who would it be and why?
So I thought I knew you were going to ask that question. And interestingly, at this point in my life, although I could join others and say, you know, Jesus, because that would obviously be an experience that anybody could dream of, I think I would want to go back to my great-great-granddad, because that's the book I'm writing about now. And I've searched and searched and searched for more about him, and I can't find it. What I found, and this I think is fascinating for your military people, this gentleman in the 1860s ended up marrying his wife, Sarah, and they had one son. And that son went to West Point. And that son founded the Army Corps of Engineers as a brigadier general. And he played football on the West Point team with a man named Smedberg, who had one son, and he had one daughter, and they married from the same football team and became my grandparents. and he became a three-star admiral in the Navy, and had two men who became admirals in the Navy, and my wife, my mom, who married a man in the Navy. So, you know, he changed everything to a Navy chain of careers. But I'd love to go back now that I've listened to him talk about his war experiences and how he, you know, he didn't want to get promoted from corporal to sergeant because, you know, he liked what he did and he didn't like officers very much. Plenty of enlisted men out there go, yeah, I understand that. I'd like to sit down with him and learn more.
That's awesome. Were you able to find like a photo of your great-great-grandfather?
I was. I found, let me see if I have it here. Might be able to go into it. I found in my mom's papers the Civil War photo. And here, if you can see it, you can see that. That's wow. Him as a young corporal on General Grant's staff. And then I found a later photograph, which is really, really tiny and hard to see, of him holding, standing with his son. And there is his son as a colonel in the United States Army, class 1894 West Point. And it, you know, it's kind of neat. I haven't found a picture of his wife, Sarah, that, you know, all the letters are two, but I found some of her descendants. The grandmothers. So I'll put those in the book too.
That's awesome. That's just history right there, man. That's great to see. So other than your books, recommend another book for our audience to read.
Oh my goodness. Now you caught me on by surprise, but I'm going to tell you the only book that I have read more than once. And that is a book called Salt. And this is a history book of the world told through salt. And in every single chapter is one where you go, oh, I didn't know that. You know, did you know that Hannibal went over the Alps with his elephants all carrying salt because it was more valuable than gold? Little things like this pop up, and it just gives you a perspective on the world that we live in. More wars have been fought over salt than any other reason, more than religion even. So, you know, it's an easy title to remember, Salt.
Salt, okay.
check that out.
Yeah. Next question, what's your favorite quote and why?
All right, now my favorite quote comes from one of my two favorite movies. I absolutely love Patton, great movie. And I loved Jeremiah Johnson with Robert Redford, which is a mountain man story. And he's been enduring incredible hardships, fighting, you know, a band of Indians that are trying to kill him. And one of the characters comes up and finds him in the snow-covered areas above the tree line, roasting a rabbit. And he looks at Robert Redford and he goes, so, you know, you wanted to be a mountain man. Were it worth all the trouble? And here's my favorite line. And what trouble? I got asked the other day on another interview by somebody, you know, if somebody were to write a book about your life, what would the title be? And I said, you did what? So that would be my title. Because, you know, what trouble?
That would be a great title for your
story. You did what?
But yeah, that's a great point. I mean, like, just having a positive outlook in life, just knowing that, yes, you will fail at times. There's going to be stressors, but, you know, just continue to move forward day by day. So
let me build on that comment. I want to make a point that I have clearly failed way more often than I have succeeded. Mm. And that's why, you know, I've been able to build a future for my kids and grandkids, because you learn so much more from failure than you do from success.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Last question here, Dr. Bob, where do you see yourself in a year, 5 years, or even 10 years from now?
I'm kind of excited about that, because 1 year, 5 years, and 10 years from now, I think I'm going to be doing the same thing I'm doing now, which is looking for ways to help others. You know, I'm on two boards of directors for veterans. I'm helping other companies, you know, learn from my past failures, because those are important lessons to share. And it's very rewarding to be able to say to somebody, you know, I'd like to help. And it's funny, because I'm working with some startup companies, and I'll throw a plug in for two of them. One is called ElectroCore, and ElectroCore has a brand new approved device that treats migraine and cluster headaches with an electrical stimulation of the vagus nerve. And they just got an emergency use authorization to be used on COVID patients, because the vagus nerve supplies the lungs and diaphragm, and it's saving lives. And I'm excited about their future. Another one is a company called Pharma Sentinel. It's out of England and Wales, and they're getting ready to launch an app probably March, April of this year to make medication management on your phone a safer, more capable way of doing business. And both of these companies have said, how shall we pay you? Right. and I love that they say that, because they think I'm motivated by money right now. And I said, you know, don't have that conversation with me right now. I've got a military retirement and I'm doing fine. Why don't you wait till I prove value? And if I prove value, talk to me then. And so it's kind of fun to say, you know, I'm not going to sign any contracts now. I'm just going to help you for the fun of helping you. And if it's sometime in the future you want to give me money, go ahead.
It's great to be in that position, right? To just be able to do that.
Well, and by the way, this is, you know, we've got military people listening. And I just had this conversation with the son of a doctor friend of mine who is just been selected for major in the Marine Special Operations side of the world. And he's going, you know, I got 14 years in, maybe I'll get out and seek my fortune elsewhere. And I went, learn from my experience, stay for retirement. You know, those last 6 years may not be the most pleasant 6 years of your life, but they're going to pay you a dividend for the rest of your life. So hang in there if you can.
Yeah, I got about 2.5 years and to retirement, so I'm almost
hang in there. Don't walk away.
So Dr. Bob, one last thing before we leave here, where can our audience stay in touch with you?
So I have one website that both of my books are on, and it has an email on there, but my email is buds81 buds81 at aol.com. that's my class number was buds81. And then the website that has both my books on it, and you can order autographed copies from, is the www.swordsandseals.com. Reach out anytime.
So swordsandseals.com and buds81@aol.com to reach out to Dr. Bob Adams. Dr. Bob, again, I appreciate you for the time, and thank you for sharing so much of your experience, Navy, Army, your experience as in medicine, and also with your books, your two books that are currently out right now, and then with another one that will be out later this year.
And don't forget Veterans Life Center in North Carolina. There are no veterans in need, send them our way.
I'll make sure we put that on the show notes.
Thank you.
All right. Dr. Bob, thank you for the time, and I'll talk to you soon.
It was a joy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hey everyone, Raiden here. I just want to thank you for listening to our podcast. And make sure you guys go check out our website, fortis-fidelis.com. Again, that's fortis-fidelis.com. And learn how you can help us support in providing these memorial coins to the families of the fallen.
And make sure you guys go follow our social media on Facebook, FRTSFDLS. Again, that's FRTSFDLS. And on Instagram and Twitter at FRTS_FDLS. Again, that's FRTS_FDLS. And make sure you guys go subscribe, review, and leave a comment on our podcast on all the podcast platforms. Till then, take care.